It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Yesterday on Capitol Hill, the Senate voted down two competing health care proposals to address expiring enhanced tax credits for the Affordable Care Act.
The deadlock on the Democratic and Republican proposals leaves millions of Americans in limbo as ACA subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year and health care premium costs are expected to rise sharply.
This creates new uncertainty for people who rely on the ACA marketplace for their health insurance, like Sarah Benferrato of Madison.
Benferrato anticipates a big premium jump next year. Here's a listen.
It's just very concerning and anxiety-inducing that it seems like all of a sudden I could be told, oh yeah, you have to pay hundreds of dollars more a month to get health insurance that might not even cover all of your health, you know, needs, costs.
To get us up to speed, we're joined now by Julie Appleby, senior correspondent at KFF Health News. Julie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So two proposals voted down. Where does this leave people in the marketplace right now?
So it leaves them still kind of confused about what's going on. It looks increasingly unlikely that these enhanced subsidies will be extended, at least not before they expire at the end of the year. But let's just be clear, these are enhanced subsidies that were made more generous during the COVID era. Subsidies themselves are still going to exist. They're just going to be smaller and less generous. And so people can still get a subsidy. It's just going to be a smaller amount. And some people who earn more than four times the federal poverty level, however, will not be able to qualify for any subsidy at all. So it really kind of varies where people are at. And I've been talking to some folks who are shopping, and some are still waiting. They're holding out. They want to wait and see if Congress does something. But time is rapidly sort of ticking down for that to happen.
Right. I mean, lawmakers have until basically next week to find a fix. What does that mean, especially when people are trying to meet a deadline? Here in Wisconsin, Monday is the deadline if you want your insurance to start January 1.
That is correct. That's true in most states. December 15th is the deadline for coverage starting January 1. But remember, the open enrollment lasts until January 15th. But, you know, some folks then might not get coverage till February 1st. A lot of people were auto re-enrolled if they already had coverage. They need to pay their bills. A lot of people need to pay their bills. So those are going to be coming up. But they may be auto enrolled. But still, most folks suggest that people at least go on the website, update their information, and see what level of subsidy they may be getting next year and what their premium prices are and what the various choices are. And we're already seeing that. I looked up some numbers for Wisconsin, and there's some numbers out nationally, and I pulled these from the national statistics. And it looks like there's about 4,000 fewer people who've touched their or newly enrolled or changed their plan this year compared with the same time last year. But it's still really early to tell what the effect will be on enrollment overall.
So there are differing policy positions that are being advanced by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and, by the way, in both chambers of Congress. Can you give us a top line takeaways on these proposals and what they would have done?
Yeah, the Democratic side wanted to extend the existing enhanced subsidies as is. Some of the proposals for 2 years, some were for three. The one that got voted down yesterday was for 3 years. The Republicans have had a variety of different ideas. The one that was voted on yesterday would have created some additional funding for what are called health savings accounts. It wouldn't have extended the enhanced subsidies, but it would have granted people who are 18 to 49, about $1,000 a year, and people who are 50 to 65, about $1,500 a year into these sort of tax-free health savings accounts that they could then use for certain medical costs. But the catch on that one was they had to enroll in a high deductible plan, either a catastrophic plan or a bronze plan. And those, the average bronze plan deductible, for example, is about $7,500 a year. So that's the amount that you have to spend before your full coverage kicks in. So these plans came with pretty high deductibles, but this money would have helped pay for some of that.
KFF, your organization, did a poll last month that says 74% of Americans support an extension of the enhanced premium tax credits. You know, what is your takeaway? Does that support for subsidies matter politically now on Capitol Hill?
I think you're seeing that. I think you're seeing a lot of moderate Republicans, especially in competitive districts, that are very concerned about this. Many of them have said that they may vote for a proposal in the House that would bring some of this forward in the House as well, but it remains to be seen what happens. But, it's not entirely too late. They could take some action. It might not happen until January. But what the state folks are telling me, at least, many states, about 20 states, run their own state-based marketplace. And they say they can adjust their marketplaces, but it might take a week or two. Let's say that they do approve some kind of enhanced tax credit for next year eventually. They could adjust them, but the results might not be seen for a little while. But that is still a possibility. But again, I think it reflects on some of the concern in some of these districts that a lot of people rely on these subsidies to get coverage.
Julie, thank you for the update. That is Julie Appleby, senior correspondent at KFF Health News. Now we turn to Wisconsin with Allison Espeseth, director of Covering Wisconsin. It's a free navigator that helps consumers enroll in and understand the ACA marketplace and Medicaid. Allison, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
What have you been hearing from Wisconsinites navigating open enrollment right now? What's the latest?
Really a lot of similar things to what was just shared, which is, people have a lot of questions about what changes might happen and if they should wait. And one of the things as a navigator agency we are really strongly encouraging is, please don't wait. Please go ahead, take action. It's really important to go ahead and actively go into healthcare.gov to see what your options are, see what is available to you, and get covered.
Are you seeing some lagging numbers this year compared to last in terms of getting enrolled or re-enrolled?
It's interesting. I would say that our incoming phone calls and web chat traffic is really similar to what it was last year. What we are seeing are people who are talking to us, making an appointment, but really not sure if they want to pull the trigger. They're just taking their time.
Mm-hmm. What impact will these enhanced health insurance premium subsidies that are expiring have on the plans that you're seeing for Wisconsin residents and the people you work with?
Well, so one of the things that was just shared, and I'll reiterate, is that it's really important to know that the premium tax credits, or this financial help, for many people still exists. So what is changing is that there were, over the past several years, expanded premium tax credits. Those are set to go away after the end of this year. What some people will see there, and well, yes, many people are going to see changes in their health coverage costs. We are seeing some folks who are seeing maybe not as big a change as they thought. In rare cases, maybe it's actually gone down. So again, it's so important just for people to take active, be proactive and to go in to actually see what is available to them, what their situation for next year will present.
So in terms of navigating people through this process, what has changed since last year as a navigator?
A lot more concerns. We, as I mentioned, folks are coming to us concerned about whether they should actually take the coverage now or they should wait. We haven't seen that in the past. And for navigators, that means maybe multiple touches per consumer, as opposed to somebody coming in, getting an appointment with us, and we take care of it. Now we might have people who come in, want to take their time, come back, think about it. A lot more questions. And one of the things we're trying to let people know, again, is just please do talk to us and talk to other enrollment help if you need help just figuring out what your options are. Don't just assume that things are going to be too expensive and you're just going to stay away. Navigators really take the time to help people understand the costs and benefits of taking coverage versus not taking coverage, and really looking at the bigger picture of taking care of your health, taking care of your finances, and not just for yourself, but for your whole family.
And Allison, for clarity, what happens if someone doesn't take action on Monday?
Yeah, so as was mentioned, so the first deadline that's coming up is December 15th. And that is to make sure that you have coverage that starts on January 1st. And that said, open enrollment does go through January 15th. So there is time. Just know that if you wait until January 15th, your coverage wouldn't start until February 1st. And also, if there are any changes that happen at the federal level with any kind of votes that may happen on the premium tax credits and expanding them or enhancing them again, we expect and anticipate that there would be some sort of guidance given to consumers about how they might take advantage of that, whether it means going back in or something happening kind of on the back end.
Are you concerned about lapses in coverage even for a month, or that there are maybe uncounted people who are simply opting out of coverage altogether in this uncertainty over premium cost increases?
So confusion about health coverage and policies and what it all means, even just the different terms, always causes and can result in folks going without. That can always be a barrier. People just find it overwhelming, which is exactly why navigators exist in the first place, is to simplify this process and just to kind of walk alongside a consumer in looking at what it all means and what it is really the best choice for them.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you. Appreciate the update.
Yeah, sure thing. Thank you.
Allison Espeseth is Director of Covering Wisconsin. It's a free navigator program within UW-Madison Extension. It helps consumers enroll in and understand the ACA marketplace, insurance, and Medicaid. Earlier, we spoke with Julie Appleby, a senior correspondent at KFF Health News, about the deadlock over competing proposals to address rising health care premiums and expanded tax subsidies under the ACA. Here in Wisconsin, as you just heard, Monday is the deadline for coverage to start January 1.
Coming up, after a court order, the Trump administration restored library and museum grant funding. What impact will this have on Wisconsin?
We're thankful to see the money come back, but we need to be able to plan and we need to move forward with being able to do innovative things for the residents of Wisconsin.
Hear from Wisconsin library and museum leaders. That's next.
The federal agency that supports libraries across the country and here in Wisconsin has restored thousands of grants canceled by the Trump administration after a court ruling last week. Over the past 15 years, the Institute of Museum and Library Services has awarded more than a dozen federal grants per year to Wisconsin museums, libraries, and archives, adding up to nearly $70 million over that time.
Library and museum leaders in the state say this loss of funding is especially critical for museums and rural libraries. In just a bit, we'll hear from the Madison Children's Museum about what that funding restoration means for their work. First, we take a look at how federal funding supports the library system in Wisconsin.
Ben Miller is state librarian for the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. That's the agency that oversees public education and libraries. Ben, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, glad to be here.
These federal grants, they bring millions of dollars to Wisconsin libraries each year. What kind of services are supported by this funding?
Absolutely. We're really happy to have these funds. The things that they provide are at the Department of Public Instruction level. We have an incredible staff who work tirelessly every day to provide consulting services, troubleshooting, best practices, that kind of thing to our libraries around the state. But more sort of tangibly, this funding provides interlibrary loan service, so being able to get a book from across the state, as well as access to electronic resources and a really innovative project. So if anyone, I know most people know Libby, which is the ebook program, that was actually started with LSTA funding years and years ago where we took it on. It was kind of a radical new idea in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And we tried it. We used federal funds to try it. We stepped ourselves off of it. And now it's one of the most successful in the nation. So that's the kind of stuff that this funding provides access to Wisconsin to.
And from what I understand, Wisconsin is a national leader in fulfilling interlibrary loans and outer library loans, patrons requesting books from not only elsewhere in the state, but around the country. What makes these programs so strong in Wisconsin?
We are. I think it's our library collaboration around the state. So our interlibrary loan is the best in the country because we have both a local consortium sharing as well as us being the sort of statewide sharing. So we have this sort of safety net of if you can't get it within your own library system in the state, then you can get it from WISCAT, which gets it from anywhere in the state or even anywhere in the country if we need to. And that's what these federal dollars provide.
And from what I understand as well, that the software is super good on this system, but there are people behind it who are also making it happen.
Absolutely. And those are the staff that I referenced before. Each request that comes to us, so not every request comes to us because most of the software does that, but when the requests come to us, we have human beings who are amazing, and they do the work of making sure that they give that sort of care and human touch to make sure that the right thing gets to the right person. I mean, I don't think we could be successful without that.
When we think of how our public libraries function, I mean, we often look to the support by local governments along with state funding and donations. What do Wisconsin libraries lose, though, if federal funding doesn't continue into the future?
So, I mean, I think what it loses is that sort of innovation of being able to move forward and do some collaborative things outside of a single municipality or library, because our libraries do amazing things and we learn a lot from our libraries. But I think we can provide that sort of backdrop to let them do their jobs and let them serve their communities really well by using these federal funds to provide services at scale that don't need to be replicated everywhere. We don't need every library to have interlibrary loan expertise. If you're a tiny library, like, we provide that for you. And then you can focus on finding the next, you know, bestseller for your patrons that are coming in. That's really the sort of multiplier effect that I think this has. And being able to try out new things like ebooks, we positioned ourselves incredibly well nationally with our ebook program because we were able to get in on the ground floor really early on to test it out, prove that it worked, and then get funding from there that was sustainable.
Does this type of federal funding support staff salaries?
It does at the DPI level. So out of our staff, we have about 19 staff at DPI that work on library issues, and 16.1 of them are federally funded. And so this is really damaging if we don't have this federal funding continued.
I feel like libraries are such a heartbeat in a community, and especially for rural areas. And I'm wondering if you can talk about rural and tribal libraries who would be disproportionately affected by the loss of federal funding. What is the significance of these federal dollars for these libraries?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when we talk about our tribal libraries, it's incredibly pronounced what this is. We saw with these grants early in the cycle, we've kind of been on this roller coaster this year with federal funding. And the Bad River Library up north had to close because their grant was taken away from them. They had to let their library director go and close the library. When they were restored, this is kind of, we've had these stops and starts, which has been pretty frustrating to deal with and takes us away from our actual work. But when that funding was restored, they were able to bring that person back because they saw the value in having a library there. And I think in our rural areas, these services are incredibly important because it might be the only place in that community where you can get access to wireless internet for free without having to pay for something. It might be the only place you can get access to the information that you need or apply for a job. In a rural area, libraries are critical infrastructure for our communities.
It seems in a bit like lights off, lights on. You know, libraries are still on shaky ground with funding. There's a lot of back and forth and uncertainty right now. What does the future hold? What about funding next year and beyond?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what we're focused on right now. So this was seeing grant funding be restored today and in this last couple of weeks has been really making me feel optimistic, but we're really looking to next year. So we are hopeful that we have money appropriated to us through the Senate and House subcommittees that are responsible for that. So we're hoping for a passage of the budget. and that will give us a grant award for next year. I think that will happen because we are through the appropriations process, but I can't, you know, I wouldn't bet on it because we just don't know what the future is going to hold. But that has been what has been most challenging about this whole thing is we're thankful to see the money come back, but we need to be able to plan and we need to move forward with being able to do innovative things for the residents of Wisconsin. And I know tribal libraries are exactly there. I've had some conversations this week and they're all wondering about their grants that went away and came back. And that comprises a lot of their operating budget. They can't operate without that. And we're at the same place as the state library agency. And we need to know with certainty that we're able to do things. Everything we're doing now is on a project basis, which isn't the best way to plan or provide services to the residents of Wisconsin.
Ben, thank you so much for the update.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Ben Miller, State Librarian for the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. That's the agency that oversees grants distributed by the Institute of Museum and Library Services. We've been talking about the significance of these federal grants, which were reinstated last week after the Trump administration canceled them earlier this year. Now we turn to museums, which also receive critical funding from the federal government to keep their community programs going. Lily Hoyer Winfield is Director of Development for Madison Children's Museum, which serves around 200,000 visitors a year. Lily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How is the work you do at the Children's Museum supported by federal grants?
Madison Children's Museum has been serving families and children for over 45 years, and federal grants like from IMLS and other institutions have been an essential partner for our work here at the museum. They help us do big community-centered projects and long-term strategic planning or creating new exhibit spaces that keep children learning. And they also fund really important small projects across Wisconsin that are really vital for museums to keep institutions running, like professional development, preservation of collections, and improvements for accessibility for visitors and staff.
So it seems like this federal funding infiltrates into a whole variety of things happening within the museum environment.
Absolutely. Yeah, the IMLS really gets museums, gets libraries, and gets how vital they are for the community and really touches all that we do.
What does it mean to have this funding restored?
The funding restored has been an incredible turning point. The disruption that happened earlier this year with the federal funding freeze and all of, frankly, the chaos that ensued around it was really difficult, not only for our staff and our visitors and our plans, but to get the funding restored just renewed our projects that we had already been granted and were really important for the work that we want to do, not only for today, but for the future of the organization. We feel very fortunate that our grants got reinstated. We're only in 8% of organizations that had grant restored at this time, thanks to a multi-state lawsuit that Wisconsin joined and the diligence of our grants administrator. So the funding allows us to stabilize projects and communicate and restart the work with our partners and move full speed ahead, completing our important work.
Right after these grants were paused or canceled in the spring, you teamed up with the Madison Public Library to do a postcard writing outreach campaign. What was on those postcards?
Oh, they were really heartfelt. So the postcards were written by both children and adults, some who are just learning how to spell and write. So that was really darling. And we dropped off over hundreds of postcards to our elected officials' offices. They read, it was anywhere from keep our museums and libraries open, they're important for our work, help me grow, help me learn, I love coming here with my family, I love coming here with my grandparent. Really heartfelt messages right directly from the folks who come and use these vital cultural institutions and organizations. It was really meaningful.
Lily, it seems like the funding situation is a little bit touch and go. What are you watching for as this back and forth situation continues with federal funding?
Well, we're really grateful that we will be completing the work for our grants that were paused. We'll be completing all that work in December by the end of this year. So we just feel like we can get some stabilization. We've had wonderful communication with our individual foundation and corporate partners and hundreds of families who support the museum. So we're just really watching for different opportunities that come up for the next few years as we go into our 50th anniversary in 2030 for projects that might still be funded by federal grants if that funding aligns with our kind of strategic direction for the museum.
Lily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, and thanks for everything Wisconsin Public Radio does for this state. We're really grateful.
That is Lily Hoyer Winfield, Development Director for the Madison Children's Museum. And earlier, we talked with State Librarian Ben Miller about the Institute of Museum and Library Services restoring millions of dollars in grant funding following a federal court ruling and the impact on Wisconsin libraries and museums.
Coming up, a Wisconsin musician's heart stopped in the middle of a performance. He tells us how quick thinking and CPR saved his life.
So when I woke up in the hospital, the doctor said, "Well, you died on stage playing drums with your band Iron Plow, but there were people there who wouldn't let you go."
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Longtime Wisconsin musician and music promoter Rocker was playing drums at a music club in Madison a year ago with his band Iron Plow when his heart stopped.
He collapsed on stage in the middle of a song.
But he survived thanks to quick intervention and CPR from staff and the audience, and because of a speedy response from EMTs with a defibrillator.
Now he's spreading the word about the need for CPR training and for automated external defibrillators, or AEDs, at music venues and elsewhere.
Rocker is a rock drummer and music scene promoter in Madison and radio host on Civic Media. Rocker, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be here.
Now share your story. What happened during your show just about a year ago?
Wow. Well, December 26th, the day after Christmas, I mean, my wife was wondering, why did you book a show at the Gamma Ray Bar for the day after Christmas? So when I woke up in the hospital, the doctor said, "Well, you died on stage playing drums with your band Iron Plow, but there were people there who wouldn't let you go." And, you know, those words really echo with me through my whole health journey of, you know, why you're here. Those questions, you know, you survived this crazy thing.
Now, you told me before we started talking, survival rates for this kind of sudden cardiac arrest, not good at all. What is it? What happened after you collapsed on stage that meant that you're here talking to me now?
Well, I think that it's important to say that only 10% of those who have a sudden cardiac arrest outside of a hospital survive. And the reason being is that the chain of survival means that you need CPR immediately to keep oxygen kind of flowing. But then you also need that electric shock from a defibrillator, an AED, portable AED probably. And oftentimes many people aren't trained in CPR, and oftentimes there isn't a portable AED close, and many people often pass at home. So the fact that it happened on stage in front of many people started that chain of survival immediately. So I was immediately able to get CPR, and the Madison Fire Department showed up in 6 minutes.
And they were able to provide the defibrillator at that point.
They provided the defibrillator and other services, you know, after that, of course. But that's really the key. The magic number is 7 minutes. After seven minutes of CPR without shock, things start to look bad.
Now, there's a video of all this. I'm not going to watch it. I don't think I could. Have you watched this?
I have. So, I have watched the video.
So you watch yourself collapse on stage.
But, I did.
So terrible, but inspiring, I guess, because people swing into action immediately.
They do, and they jump up there. And that's what's most important is that, you know, that chain of survival has to happen immediately with CPR if you plan to come out with your faculties still and survive, right? So it's just very incredible to watch the video. One of the reasons that I released the video is because, like a drowning, people maybe think, you know, there's this big splashing and I'm drowning and yelling. It's much like sudden cardiac arrest. No, they fall right under the waves. Sudden cardiac arrest, you just slump over and you're gone. And really, you're really gone unless there are other people there who won't let you go.
Now, since this, you've become an evangelist for a couple things to help people in this situation survive.
Yeah.
One is you are going to venues and I think other places saying, hey, think about getting an AED, one of these automated external defibrillators. I like calling them AEDs because I can't say that word.
It's a funny word, isn't it? You're absolutely right. I think that there are places like the Sylvie Theater that are maybe have better resources and they're able to have these machines. But the Gamma Ray Bar, you know, mom and pops and some small venues, I thought, you know, they may not have the resources to do it or even be thinking about it, actually. I wasn't thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And it raised awareness to me and the fact that this does happen in bars. And when you talk to Kevin Wilmot, who owns the Gamma Ray Bar, this was not the first time. Rob DZ just had a sudden cardiac arrest at the Gamma Ray Bar. And while he was working at the High Noon Saloon, where he received his CPR training, mm-hmm. he's fans and musicians alike. And so it really happens in these, you know, crowded situations.
And you're also saying, hey, if you haven't gotten trained on CPR,
this is
for everybody, right?
Yes.
Get that training.
That's right. You know, and you can just search CPR training Madison, and there's a lot of resources out there. So it's very easy to find. The Pulse Point app from the Madison Fire Department is another thing. When you're trained in CPR, you can register with the app. And if there's an experience where they need somebody who knows CPR, it will alert you at a notification. The closest people to wherever the sudden cardiac arrest may happen.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that Pulse Point. You were telling me about that. I don't know if other communities around the state have it. Pulse Point, you voluntarily sign up and you can be
right.
alerted, hey, I'm at the Paradise, say, next to the Gamma Ray, and there's a cardiac arrest right next door.
That's right. Or you could look to find out where is the nearest portable AED
wow.
machine located, you know, maybe right next door, maybe across the street. So there's so many resources available for this. It's pretty amazing. And again, with Madison Police Department, they actually have a program like a library. They give out their portable AED machines to like events. So for instance, at Atwood Fest, we had two of them this year. One of them we kept in our backstage area, and luckily we didn't have to use it, but it's fortunate that we have that program.
And we're between Thanksgiving and the holiday season now. Rocker, I know I've seen online you've been expressing some gratitude. Do you want to shout out the various points of gratitude you feel that had
Boy,
you
know, there were so many people. You know, my cardiologist, Merrill Johnson, is just amazing. The cardio rehab team over at UW Health are absolutely amazing in the gym. They're really one of the most important parts of my health journey. You know, family at home, the structure that you have is absolutely important for this. And UW Health in general, I think they get an A++. And hey, they have the best hospital food anywhere.
December 26, 2024, this happens to you. December 26, 2025, you're playing same band, same stage.
December 26th this year, I am playing the anniversary, and we're going to make it a little bit of a benefit and a little bit of an awareness about all of these issues, you know, myths behind sudden cardiac arrest and the resources and CPR and AED, and I'm going to go face it, go play on the same exact stage 1 year later. It was pretty amazing because my comeback show was September 14th, and so that was literally 8.5 months after my incident, and I thought it was just an incredible journey to get back to that point, because I really looked at being able to play my drums as hey, where are you in your health journey? Because, hey, let's face it, I use big sticks, and I don't play in a country band.
Rocker, thanks a lot for joining us. Glad you're here with us.
Thank you, Rob. It's been fun.
That was Madison musician Rocker talking about his heart attack on stage and the CPR that saved his life. Now we turn to the cardiologist who treated him after the emergency call. Dr. Merrill Johnson is a heart failure and transplant cardiologist at UW Health and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Certainly always glad to talk about Rocker and his journey with his heart disease.
Yeah, in cases like Rocker's, how much difference does quick intervention by bystanders with things like CPR really make?
No, I mean, it's life and death. EMS can get there pretty rapidly, but the minimum amount of time that people can be without blood flow to the brain, blood flow to the other organs, that's critical to their good survival.
I've taken CPR classes myself a couple times. Full disclosure, I'm way overdue for a refresher. But what are the key skills that people take away that they could use if they're in an emergency like this?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the CPR classes have changed a lot over the year. I think the main thing that people are focusing on now for the lay public are the chest compressions. And that's just kind of pressing hard on kind of the lower end of the sternum and deep and fast, and making sure, because that actually allows perfusion. Now, in the medical field, we also do the breathing part, but I think that the chest compressions are what's felt to be the most important for the lay public, and also things people are more comfortable with doing.
Yeah, and I got to say, having done those classes, I'm thinking as I'm doing the compressions, is this really doing that much on a physical level? When I'm doing those compressions, What is happening that's going to help with survival, that's going to help avoid brain injuries and things like that?
So when you're actually compressing, that is the pushing down phase, that is actually expelling blood from the heart to the organs. And when you release, then some of that blood comes back into the lungs and the heart. You compress again, it's pumped out. So it really is kind of an artificial way to pump blood through the body.
Now, a part of Rocker's mission since this whole thing was to get more places, including music venues, to have AEDs, the automated external defibrillators. Easier to say AED, I guess. What do those add to the quick response?
Well, basically, it's kind of a packet that's almost self-explanatory. So if someone kind of is down in a public venue, they don't have a pulse, they're not breathing, it's kind of something you open up and there are instructions there. You put the patches on. It does. You turn the device on. It tells you whether shock or no shock, continue CPR and that kind of thing. So it's really a very self-explanatory, easy way to try to shock the heart back into a regular rhythm, if indeed an abnormal rhythm is the cause of the problem. Because again, the sooner we get back normal, consistent heart rhythm, the better blood flow we get to the brain and the other body organs, and the more likely there is a successful outcome for the patient that has arrested.
Dr. Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Dr. Merrill Johnson, heart failure and transplant cardiologist at UW Health and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She was part of the treatment team for Rocker, who we heard from earlier. He survived a heart attack during a performance on stage thanks to CPR from bystanders. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.